just so you know, the handouts, I'm not including the slides for several reasons, but there's a job aid, which is actually one side of a job aid we usually provide with our workshops on fluency building, and it's pretty useful. I think that by the time we get to the end, you will have used it a little bit, and it'll probably make sense to you. And then we've got a couple little exercises in here. And then there's an article called Closing the Confidence Gap, which if you happen to notice the date, it's pretty old. It's almost 20 years old. I've been writing about and doing research on this stuff, behavioral fluency, since I was a graduate student in the 70s. So it's an old topic for me. And in fact, if you go to... I've got to find my other clicker thing here. If you go to our website, which is a little more complicated than it should be, but binder-rea.com, publications.htm, or just go to binder-rea.com, helpful resources, I think is the name of the page, you'll find a whole lot of articles that you can download, quite a few about fluency, specific applications like sales and call centers and computer training, also lots of other stuff about measurement and other performance technology topics. So I think they'll provide you more than the slides certainly could. This presentation is kind of a subset, of a small subset of the whole fluency building approach, but I think in focusing on these things that we call fluency blockers and fluency builders, you'll sort of get the essence of some of the key ideas in the fluency building approach. How many people know, have sort of either read about or kind of applied or anything related to fluency-based instruction or fluency-based training? Okay, so it's a new topic for most people. Despite the fact it's been around for a long time, it's not something that's normally part of, you know, instructional design training and all of that kind of stuff, and it's a very specific thing. So what we're going to do, first of all, is talk a little bit about some of the problems and challenges that I think anybody who's involved in training or coaching or developing performance might have encountered over the years. And then really get to the heart of what this whole fluency topic is, which is, what does it mean to be good at something, at anything? You know, whether it's doing your job or playing the guitar or shooting baskets, just about anything. And then I'm going to provide you a very, very brief summary, relatively speaking, of some of the background, some of the concepts and research related to this topic. And then we're going to talk about these factors or these variables or however you want to describe them we call fluency blockers and fluency builders. I'm going to show you the job aid and you're going to do a couple little exercises and then we'll see where we are in terms of discussion and questions. I wonder if any of these sound familiar to you. You know, trainees passing tests at the end of instructional modules, but then they go on the job and they don't seem to perform as well as expected. That ever happened to you? Or trainees can't remember what they learned. This is a classic one, you know, the retention problem of, geez, I passed a test on that, but, you know, it starts in college or high school, I suppose, when we cram, but, you know, it's a real issue in training in terms of return on investment. Or problems with task endurance and attention span. How about new trainees who then go on the job, and especially if it's a complicated job, having a hard time just kind of paying attention and staying up with it? I, of course, started out with this work back in the 70s in education with kids. And there's all these attention deficit disorder issues and so forth. And although some of them may be biochemical and some of them may be who knows what related to video games, you know, there's all kinds of theories. One of my strong views, is that it's also related to the fact that our kids are no longer actually achieving fluency in much of anything in the first few grades or even throughout school, at least in this country, at least in America. But anyway, that's a whole other topic. If you want to read more about that, you can find that on the websites that I mentioned too. How about people struggling with the mechanics, the basics? And by that I mean whether it's typing or, you know, in a customer service environment, just not being able to find stuff that's available or just basic sales blocking and tackling. Is that a common thing? Where just the basic skills and knowledge are getting in people's way? Okay. And then difficult applying. I mean, that's really the bottom line, isn't it? We talk about maintenance and application and people going through some sort of training or coaching program. And then the question is, can they use it, whatever it is that they learned? And that, I think, in a way, is the return on investment question. Because if we invest a lot in training and coaching and skill development, then what do we get for it is the bottom line. I've worked a lot in customer call centers, for example. Anybody here ever do that? Okay, a few, but you know, call centers, I've more than once had the experience where I went in and had a conversation with supervisors and managers, you know, and they say, well, the problem is they go through new hire training and then they come on the job and we have to train them, you know. I mean, it's not always a wonder that training people in organizations are sometimes viewed as not so high on the totem pole, because a lot of times the products of our work don't seem to be so compelling. Not always, but sometimes. So the question is, why do these things happen? What do you think some of the factors are? Anybody have suggestions? Yes. Yeah, and so what are the implications of that? What do you mean by that?
Well, we rely on verbal information. We think that that's the key to performance.
Okay. Now, of course, sometimes it is, in the sense that if I'm in sales and service, I have to get good at using verbal information. But that's not really what you're talking about, is it? You're talking about the passive reception of it. So there's so we aren't performance focused, I think, is part of what you're saying, right? Yeah, well, we'll get into that for sure. Any other hypotheses about kind of what the problem is here? Yes?
We don't necessarily communicate what it is we want people to do, so it doesn't transfer to the training, so you're training people to do things that don't meet the target of the
Yeah. Now, that's a whole other topic, but one of my favorite topics is the fact that when we focus our training on skills and knowledge rather than the work outputs that we expect people to produce on the job, very often you can learn all there is to know about Microsoft Word, but you still don't know how to produce a good memo or whatever it is. So that kind of thing. Any other thoughts about it? Yes.
Like so many types of organizations, we go after the low-hanging fruit and don't put the extra effort, money, resources into to get the level of evaluation, targeting a higher level.
Fair enough. Okay, well, several of your comments are exactly on target with this presentation, because what I'm going to suggest is at least one of the fundamental issues, and I would propose maybe the, or at least among the top couple, at the heart of this problem is a misunderstanding about what it means to be good at something and how we measure it, which is, as you're suggesting, about how high we set the bar and all of that. It's also related, actually, to our academic histories, because how things get measured in the academic environment should be different than how they get measured in our world. So, you know, the way I think of this is we have a largely unconscious assumption that mastery means to be 100% correct at something, or 95% correct, or whatever. There's an accuracy focus. Now, that's not surprising, because most of us since kindergarten have been evaluated in a world where, you know, if we had grades, you know, A was 93 to 100 or whatever, and B was 86, whatever those levels are, it was all about accuracy. And that's a problem. I was fortunate to be one of Dr. Skinner's last graduate students, and that may be a good thing from your perspective or not so good a thing, but one of the things about Dr. Skinner is he said, in an interview at one point, he said, my most important contributions were rate of response in the cumulative response recorder. Now, what rate of response is the count of behavior, whatever it is, over time. There's a time dimension. Now, because I'm in the lineage of Skinner, I sort of learned that early on in the 70s when I was working in education. And that has big implications. As his daughter, who became an educational psychologist of some renown in her own right, said, I think rather nicely, and she was talking about kids, but she said teaching is not only producing new behavior, it's also changing the likelihood that a student will respond in a certain way. Since we can't see a likelihood, we look instead at how frequently a student does something. We see how fast he can add. The student who does problems correctly at a higher rate is said to know addition facts better than one who does them at a lower rate. Now, that's not a common perspective in the educational world, although it more and more is. If any of you are connected in any way to school education, you may be aware that among kids, there's now things like progress monitoring where people are actually looking at how many math facts can you do in a minute, how many words can you read, and so forth. But she's focusing, too, on this time dimension that Skinner was pointing to. Before we go any further, though, and believe me, we're going to drill further into this measurement thing, the word that we're talking about here is fluency. And I started using that word 30-some years ago, in part because most people already have an intuitive understanding of what it means. So if you can find in the handout or the back of a piece of paper a blank place to do a little scribbling, what I like to do is to give you a minute, And I'd like you to take the word fluency or behavioral fluency, however you want to, you know, fluency is a good word, and just jot down as many ideas of what you think that means, what its implications might be, why it's important. Just sort of do a free association on the word fluency, and let's see what we get, okay? And don't worry about long sentences and stuff, because the idea is to just get as many ideas as you want, as you can, and then we'll talk about it. So please begin. Ah, good idea. Okay, please stop. Could you maybe push the buttons over there to increase the lights? I think they're at the other side of the door there. There's like five little buttons. I think the top two maybe, if you press them. I'm just thinking people might want a little more light than we had. Okay, so what'd you come up with? What kind of words and phrases?
Mastery.
Mastery, there you go. It's a good word.
Effortless.
Effortless, okay. That's, yep, good. Keep going.
Uninterrupted.
Uninterrupted. Could be. Could, of course, be interrupted every so often at an appropriate pace, but absolutely.
Consistency.
Excuse me?
Consistency.
Consistency, definitely. If you think about somebody who is fluent in a foreign language, of course, which is what, you know, what we kind of originally think of that word, it is about consistently getting it right at an appropriate pace. Others?
Unconscious competence.
Now, unconscious competence. That's a great word, or a great phrase. It sometimes is unconscious and sometimes it's very conscious, but in any case, it's definitely competence. But a lot of the things we do in that way that you're talking about are definitely fluent, for sure. Absolutely. Yes?
Adapt to new situations.
Oh, good. Adapt to new situations. One of the things that I like to think about with fluency is improvisational behavior, and it might start with jazz music or Michael Jordan playing basketball, or for that matter, a great executive or manager adjusting to the situation. And what it usually means is there's fluent, a repertoire of pieces that are all fluent. Knowledge, decisions, facts, etc. And you're able to adjust those. It's just like Michael Jordan kind of used to be, at least, adjusting his shot as he's halfway in the air. You know, more?
It's similar to maybe interrupted, but without reflexive hesitancy.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't put the word hesitant or reflective in there, but absolutely, without sort of, yeah, exactly, that's right. I often say without hesitation. More?
Ability to work seamlessly.
Yeah. Good one. Any affective words, feeling words, kind of, subjective experience words? I'm sorry? Natural, yeah. And then what was the one you had?
Confident.
Yeah, you might have noticed the title of that article that I gave in your handouts. You may or may not have called something like Bridging the Confidence Gap. And for years, I focused on the sort of technical aspects and the measurement of fluency and all that and the implications of fluency. But what we started to notice, of course, is what you're saying. Someone who is fluent appears natural. They're confident. I work in customer service environments, as I mentioned, a lot of times. And it's interesting because when you're on the telephone listening to a customer service person, you know, if you're a customer, if the person is very fluent, they're talking smoothly and know their facts, you feel, not only do they sound confident, but you feel confident. But, you know, if they're saying, and they're not fluent, then not only are they not confident, but you aren't either as the customer. So there's a big component there. Any more? Fluid and flow, definitely. Yeah, those are good words. More?
Smooth,
definitely. Any things about kind of the results of or the impact of being fluent? You've already mentioned a few, like adaptability and stuff. Any more?
Synergy.
Say more about that.
Sense of continuity.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. And also, because what I thought you might be meaning too, but I think it's consistent with some what other people said. Synergy, I always think of coming together or being together. And, you know, when you look at a complex performance, whether it's a musician or a customer service representative or an athlete or a anybody, there's a bunch of stuff happening at once often that comes together smoothly. Yes?
As a result, perspective of trusting.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because that kind of goes along with the confidence thing, I think, doesn't it? Yes?
I mean, it's simple, but high performance.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, we could go on and this, and you get it. That's why I love the word. Everybody sort of gets this stuff. And so it's a word that translates easily. You know, I go into companies often and I'll give some sort of executive overview or some presentation and I'll come back, you know, weeks later and everybody's using what I jokingly refer to as the F word. You know, they're all kind of talking about fluency. Now, of course, understanding it and the implications for design are two separate things. And I want to just dig in a little bit into some of the design issues today. But that's what it's about. Now, from a technical point of view, sort of from a definitional point of view, these are the kinds of phrases that we've been using for years to describe fluency, and I think they're quite compatible with all the things you've been saying. You know, the sort of the core idea that we start out with is a notion of accuracy plus speed. The idea that you have to get it right, and you got to be quick. Now, the only problem with that phrase is it's a little limiting. There are some things that aren't just right or wrong. There are some things where there's a qualitative judgment. Like, for example, if I'm listening into a customer service person, the choice of words, the tone of voice, there's a bunch of things in there that are qualitative distinctions. If I'm listening to somebody blow saxophone notes or play guitar notes, there's a qualitative distinction about what good ones are or not. If somebody's drawing a figure, there's qualitative descriptions I can have about whether it's accurately traced the arm or whatever. So that's why the second kind of combo is there, which is sometimes it's about quality, and then the other part of it is it's not always about raw speed. You know, I talk kind of fast sometimes, maybe always, I don't know. But anyway, and sometimes people think, oh, it's just all about fast. Well, it is to some extent, but not really, because there's a lot of things where it's just a confident pace. If you're speaking, again, with a professional about something on the phone for a help desk or anything, you don't want them to be talking too fast, but there's something about the appropriate pace. And when we practice things like sort of soft skill verbal interactions, like supervisor feedback and things like that, or information that salespeople need to know about products or markets and so forth, we will often use the criterion normal confident pace. And by that, we mean that the person is speaking at a normal rate for them, the same rate they would if they were talking about their grandmother or something, you know. And that may be different in Mississippi than it is in Boston, but there's definitely a temporal dimension. There's definitely a time dimension. Now, I think you hit on this one, doing the hesitation issue. So doing the right thing without hesitation is another way to think about it. A lot of things we don't do repeatedly or continuously. Like if you're a manager or a supervisor and have to intervene in real time in some situation, you need to be able to make a decision correctly right there, say the correct things, move smoothly into it and deal with it, whatever it is. So there's lots of cases where this is really what we're kind of talking about. This gets to the unconscious competence in those areas, those kind of phrases. Cognitive psychologists talk about automaticity. One of the things I love about fluency is, despite the fact that I was, you know, a student with Mr. Behaviorist, Fred Skinner, the fact is we can easily translate fluency into any cognitive model you want. It's about moving into long-term memory. It's all the kind of theoretical framework that cognitivists bring to the table, comes out looking like fluency, automaticity, etc. And then, as somebody said at the very beginning, I call it true mastery, which is kind of just emphatic. But the reason I do that is because if you think about levels of performance at almost anything, there's some level where people can't do anything at all. You know, they just don't know anything yet. And then there's a second level that I would call beginner's level. And usually that's some combination of being inaccurate, not completely accurate, and slow or hesitant. Now, unfortunately, I would suggest that most education programs and most training programs leave learners to some extent there. Would you more or less agree with me? I think if we all are honest, we'll say that. Not always. If there's a really rigorous criterion referenced approach, maybe not, but that's rare. So unfortunately, people are left usually at the end of training with kind of a beginner's level. And the question is, how do they get better? Now, there have been some people who've suggested a very rigorous accuracy criterion is what we really need. So, for example, some years ago, Benjamin Bloom, some of you may know the famous instructional objectives guy, and a few other people, talked about mastery learning. And the idea was that at every step in a curriculum or in a learning hierarchy, that you ought to be essentially perfectly correct before you move on to the next one. Now, a lot of people argued about that. They said, wait a minute, that's too rigid. You know, how can you have perfection? It maybe isn't realistic, blah, blah, blah. But the point I would make is, whether it's 100% or 90% or whatever we decide, that's not going to be good enough either, because what we need is this time dimension. There's an enormous difference between somebody who can pass a test at 100% correct in 2 hours and somebody who can finish the test in 10 minutes, right? Huge difference. And in our workshops around this, we do lots of exercises where people get a feeling for that. You know, you take a multiple choice test on something you know cold, and you just go boom, 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 boom. You aren't guessing or anything. It's whoosh, you know the answers. You give them a multiple choice test on something that they're not quite so sure of, and people are using guessing strategies and all this stuff. And they might get to the end, and they might have close to perfect answers. But the fact is, it took them a long time. And if you dig into it, you realize they didn't know it very well at all. They were using their test-taking skills. So the point is, we got to get people up to here at some point if they're going to be proficient on the job. Oops, sorry. And the thing is, we need to get your attention. I know it's after lunch and stuff, but the thing is, there's two components to this of how we get people there. One is, and you can certainly imagine or guess this or know this, it's about practice. Now, what I'm going to suggest a little bit later is the way you design practice makes an enormous difference. And a lot of the practice activities we sometimes develop as trainers or managers or coaches may not work so well because they practice too big of chunks and there's a lot of other issues. But the other part that may or may not be so obvious, but once said I think it is ergonomics, the design of the environment, the user interface, how easy it is to use the job aids, whether the tools require you to do something weird or not. The idea being that it's kind of stupid to practice on stuff that's really badly designed and hard to use. It's like pushing big rocks up a hill. So as a performance improvement professional, my interest is in first looking at the information ergonomics, the tools, the stuff like that that people use, getting that right, and then say, let's practice on this. Yes?
I'm glad you mentioned job aids because I'm a little bit puzzled by the issue of speed. There's a lot of performance things that we do, which I think we might, we don't need to do to recall. So
that's fair enough. That's right. It's the same distinction as Joe Harless used to make between learning to recall and job aids.
Right.
But if you're going to learn it to recall, you better be fluent.
Right.
And if you're using job aids, we better give you enough practice and design those job aids properly so you can use them fluent. The problem is that we usually don't do either very well. You know, for example, in a lot of environments where people are using online web things,
right,
information things, sometimes they're so badly designed, it's horrible in the first place. But even if they're well designed, a lot of times the way training works is there's some kind of exploration of the thing, but there's no practice that really gets people to the point where you say, can you find this? Where people just go boom and can find it. And the same thing goes for some of our job aids. You know, we develop job aids, and the good ones we use or test to be sure that they work well, and then when we introduce them, we want to be sure people can use them efficiently. So I agree with you completely. I'd like to minimize the amount of stuff that we need to stick up here, but if we're putting it on this, I want to be sure it's fluent too. Okay?
Fluency would be in
the use of it. You got it. That's right. That's absolutely right. So this is one of my late mentors and teachers, Eric Houghton. He put it in sort of plain English. He said you can take behavior out of time. That is, you can ignore the time dimension. You know, you can pretend like it doesn't exist. You can give people an infinite amount of time to do whatever it is you're asking them to do. But the fact is, you can't take time out of behavior. It's an essential characteristic of behavior. And the difference between somebody, for instance, when we used to build paper sales guides for people, we would design them and test them to be sure that people could, if you said, find this, that they were indexed and organized and structured properly so they could open them and find the stuff they needed right away instead of having to page through it for 15 minutes. So the temporal dimension is a big component of performance. And again, it's not always that we need to do stuff fast, But we do need to do it without hesitation. It does need to be right there in our repertoire. As Gagne, the instructional design guy used to talk about being immediately accessible to us, whatever that repertoire skill is. Now, here's some data which you might initially think is kind of weird because it's from a long time ago and it's from severely disabled students that I was working with in the 70s in a state institution called the Fernald State School, which was the oldest institution in the Western Hemisphere for developmentally delayed, or we then called people mentally retarded, people. And these were folks who'd lived in the institution their whole lives, and they were between 12 and 54 years old. And we were also working with some regular little kids in public schools between 5 and 7 years old. And then we had a bunch of professional adults around who happened to have master's and doctoral degrees for the most part. Now, because we were working with these students, and we were trying to teach them, really for the first time that almost anybody had tried to do this, we were trying to teach these people to read and do simple math skills and a bunch of what people might think of as academic skills, but they were actually functional skills for the community, for things like telling time and navigating their world and paying for things at the store and like that. We were teaching them some very basic component behavior, so things like fine motor skills, putting pegs into a pegboard as quickly as you can, copying printing strokes, which means we've got dashes and slashes and curves and things like that. How quickly can you just copy those as a component of printing your name? Copying numerals of various kinds repeatedly, writing ones, zeros, dashes, sevens, fours, nines, different kinds of numbers that are to different degrees difficult, naming pictures that are laid out in arrays, naming numbers that are randomly ordered, 6, 4, 3, 8, 9, like that. Rote counting, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, like that. Putting tiles into a can, which is a very simple fine motor skill. Counting tiles into a can, which is these two skills in one-to-one correspondence. Each time I say a number, I put one into a can. Counting fixed tiles and counting up tiles from a set. Now, it's a really simple behavior, obviously. We gave the people in each of these groups 30-second timings, and we counted how many correct of each of these things they could do. And so what you see here are the ranges for each of these three groups of the count per minute. In other words, here the state school persons were but someplace between 5 a minute and about 18 a minute correct. And the regular little kids were between about 18 or 19 a minute and about 32 a minute and so forth, okay? Now, it's not surprising, if you look at these, you'll realize that on something like 11 of the 16 skills, all of the adults can do more correct per minute than all of the regular kids, than all of the severely handicapped people. No big deal. If you watch these people walking across the street or you know, sitting, doing something, it would be clear. But the shocking part is that if you looked at them on a percent correct scale, they all look the same. Now, you've got to let this sink in a little bit. You might say, oh, yeah, oh, very interesting. But it's actually deeper than that. Because consider the fact that both in our education world and most of our training world, this is the measurement framework, so-called, that we use. And if it can't distinguish between a person with a PhD and a severely handicapped person writing numbers or naming pictures, we're in big trouble. Because if you can't tell the difference, you don't know that you have to do something to help them. And so this comes out in the first thing I had on those problems and challenges where, for example, people pass tests, but then they can't perform on the job. Well, often those tests are accuracy-based, beside the fact that they're multiple choice and verbal and all the things you were implying about an educational versus a performance model. They are often not timed. You get as long as you need to get them done in many cases, or at least plenty of time. So we can't tell the difference between the person who just has the stuff nailed and the person who kind of has to mess around with it for a while and guess and all that. Or even assembling something or finding something on the web that you need to talk to customers about, we usually don't look at the time dimension. We're usually looking at something equivalent to this. So you know, the idea here is that the way I try to describe it is we're trapped in this box, a percent correct. And there's a kind of an invisible ceiling at 100% correct. That's the best that our measurement tool can give us. And in fact, I always like to make the analogy, someday I'll change this slide actually and do this, but you know, back in the Christopher Columbus days, there were these maps, and they'd have kind of Northern Europe, you know, and some other stuff, and then they'd have some little water things, and then they'd have like the sea monsters out there, which was like, they didn't know what was out there. Well, it's kind of like this. Our measurement system is very much like this. The traditional learning literature has this phrase, overlearning, Does anybody know what it means? It means when you practice something that's already 100% correct, and you keep practicing it, that's overlearning. The problem is we can't measure it, because you can't do better than 100% correct. But what we know from research is that if you do a bunch of overlearning trials, you remember stuff longer. You have better transfer of training, etc. All these long-term effects get better. But the problem is we don't know how to set criteria for the thing because our measurement system won't let us get better than 100% correct. On the other hand, if we look at something like how long it takes somebody to do or count per minute, which is a kind of standard unit of measure in our fluency building methodology, there's no inherent limitation to it. The limitations only have to do with a person's physiological limits or maybe the physical limits. Maybe the website won't move any faster than I can navigate. But the measurement system itself has no inherent limit. And because it has a time dimension, it's a true measure of performance. Thing is, if I ask you to show me, what does it look like to do 80% correct on anything? You can't actually show me unambiguously. Did that mean I did 8 out of 10 in 5 minutes? Or 80 out of 100 in an hour and a half? What does it mean? I don't know. But if I say, show me what it looks like to do 25 a minute correct and 6 a minute errors, you could absolutely show me that. Because the time dimension makes it into an actual performance measure. Whereas percent correct is what scientists call a dimensionless quantity. Because when you do the percent thing, you know, you divide 8 by 10 or whatever, you get rid of the dimensions, and all of a sudden it's just a ratio. So there's a fundamental measurement problem. And it's not widely recognized, although people are starting to get it in certain areas. And obviously certain areas in professional work, like assembly work and stuff, people kind of get that at the productivity level. You know, when you're measuring calls in a call center. But if you translate that into training, it's very seldom taken into account. So that's, to me, at the heart of the problem. Now, there's a whole lot of implications of this, but one of the things I like to do is jump outside of training and education, because it turns out that athletes and coaches and musicians get this a lot better than those of us who've been buried in education and training for years. In fact, probably my most successful client in terms of building fluent performance in a client organization was a former basketball coach who absolutely got this. And John Wooden, who was at one time considered the greatest college basketball coach ever, I think maybe Bobby Knight is now, got a better record, I don't know. But anyway, he said, skill as it pertains to basketball is the knowledge and the ability to quickly and properly to execute the fundamentals. Being able to do them is not enough. They must be done quickly. And being able to do them quickly isn't enough either. They must be done quickly and precisely at the same time. You must learn to react properly, almost instinctively. That's what I thought you meant by synergy, by the way, this notion of coordination. Another example, in a very different area, this is actually a former colleague of mine when I was working with Medtronic. Tim Deer was one of their subject matter experts. He was a surgeon, very, very efficient surgeon and really good one. I was talking with him about this, and he said, having good hands is a primary determinant of a surgeon's success in the operating room. That means he or she can complete surgical procedures quickly, smoothly, and correctly for both medical and financial success. Anybody go through medical school or have a spouse or friend who has? Well, one of the things that they do if they're trained to be surgeons is they actually practice doing sutures, for example, on pig's feet or on cadavers or on tomatoes. Because the thing is, if your heart is your chest is laid open, your brain is open or something, you want to be sure the guy can stitch you up pretty quick, you know, and accurately get the thing done right. And so there's a whole lot of skills in the medical profession that have clinical implications. But also, as Deer used to point out, the difference between being able to, for example, implant a pain control device in the body and finish the procedure in 15 minutes versus 45 minutes is the difference between a financially successful medical practice and one that's not successful. So, you know, you can go all over the place and find these time things, and music is another big area. I don't want to go deeply into the research stuff, and if you want to go to our websites, you can find some of my more academic-type papers on this. But the thing is, this isn't just some sort of peculiar thing. There's a whole bunch of areas of research that are pointing in the same direction. Like, there's some very old verbal learning research. And by that I mean when people learn verbal associations or they learn chains of words. Most people, when they do that research, they just look at percent correct. But there were a few people who did that research and they measured how quickly the people could respond. And what they found was, as you might guess, once 100% correct was hit, if you kept measuring the time dimension, the response got quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. And in fact, some of the cognitive psychologists who were in a field called human information processing, a famous paper by LaBerge and Samuels on automaticity, points out that as that response gets quicker and quicker, the ability to sort of disturb it by some distracting stimulus gets hard. It gets harder and harder to do that because you're more and more what we would call confident. Human factors engineering is a design or engineering science about making environments more able to support fluent performance, you know, airplane cockpits, user interfaces, that kind of thing. I come from this tradition of operant conditioning, Skinner's work, where count per minute was the measure. And then Ogden Lindsley, who was a Gilbert Award guy in ISPI some years ago before he passed away, his field of precision teaching, where he started applying this with kids. And then the use of what we call fluency standards or AIMS, what I call retention, endurance, application, performance standards, which you don't have to remember that one. But there's this whole lineage of stuff that where I come from. But, you know, again, you can go up to perceptual motor learning research. In the old days, especially during the Second World War and after, when a lot of laboratory scientists were studying, how do you teach people to interact with complex consoles where you have a bunch of buttons, levers, and stuff, and you got things to watch, and dials. What they found was if you get the components, the discriminations and the behavior going quickly, it's easier to put them together. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that points in the same direction. And I like to summarize it by saying there's basically three major chunks. The first one, and they're slightly different actually, but I tend to bunch them together, is that we've learned that when people achieve quick, accurate responding, they both remember things in the sense of, we use the word retention, and they also maintain their skills and knowledge better. And these are really two things. Retention, in a way, is silly from our point of view, because retention is about, I teach you something, and now I don't give you a chance to do it at all for a long time, and then I check to see if you remember. Now, it turns out if I've gotten fluent, my memory will be much better. And the cognitive person would talk about it being in long-term memory and things like that. But frankly, if we're designing curriculum, we probably ought to be designing curriculum where people actually get to use the thing either in the next skill in the hierarchy or on the job. So in a certain way, this research is less practically relevant. But the maintenance stuff is not. And the maintenance idea is this. How many times have you ever learned a new piece of software, for example, in some training exercise or program, where you sort of learned about how it worked, and then you had to go back in the job? And then there was maybe an old way you used to do the thing that you were pretty good at. How likely is it that you're going to do the thing the new way? Unless somebody's like over your shoulder saying, you have to do it the new way. Less than likely. I remember back in the 80s when there were first so-called executive computing programs. I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember that, but I am. Anyway, you know, where we were first trying to introduce executives to PCs, because traditionally they had their secretaries and their assistants, you know, to write memos and do dictation and all that. And so the idea was, oh, well, we got the PC. We're going to teach these guys to do spreadsheets and word processing now. So they'd take them through these 1 or 2 day courses. And at the end, they kind of knew how the software worked. But it was still way better and quicker for them to dictate to Susie or have somebody else do the spreadsheet from their handwritten notes than it was for them to use the computer. So it wasn't maintained. They didn't do the behavior, get the natural consequences, and use it. Now, there's a few other examples of that in my work, sales and customer service. If you're in a world where you've got to look stuff up in a web environment, and if you never get fluent at that, there's a high probability if you're in a real-time situation with a customer that you're going to do what one of my clients said once, which is go to MSU, making stuff up. That is, you don't have time to kind of like, I don't know where it is, and look it up. And you feel stupid about it, and you're not confident in all those things. So you take your best shot. And sometimes it's okay, but sometimes you make bad mistakes, and sometimes there's even legal consequences. But the thing is, the behavior of looking things up is not maintained because it's not fluent enough to get the right result and then have the payoff of getting the right result. And it's across the board in a lot of things. In salespeople, I used to work a lot with software salespeople, you know, who had to sell complicated enterprise-level software to big companies. And they were real comfortable talking to other techie people because often they came from a technical background. But one of the big things that I was often called into about was, geez, if they got to go talk to the chief financial officer, they don't kind of know the words. They don't have the vocabulary. They're not fluent. And so what happens? They actually avoid going to talk to the chief financial officer. And if we can teach them fluently to ask a few questions and respond to a few things and actually have some confidence, at least with a small repertoire, even if it's just sort of cocktail-level party stuff, but they're smooth and confident about it, they're willing to go talk to the CFO, and then it maintains, and you get the natural payoff. So the maintenance thing is a big deal. Second one is what I call endurance, and it's really a metaphor. It's like I started using this word based on, I used to live a couple blocks from where the Boston Marathon went by at about, I don't know, mile 19 or something. And as some of you may know that have ever watched or participated in marathons, it's common you have these thousands of people running along, and all kinds of folks are holding out cups of water for them and everything. And there's a lot of times garbage cans along the way that people deposit the, you know, cups. And it was always interesting because toward the front of the group, the people who had more endurance, you know, they'd come to one of these garbage cans that might be tipped over in their way, and they'd just kind of go over it and they'd keep going, you know. But you get to the people that are toward the, further back in the crowd that don't have that much endurance, they'd get to one of these garbage cans and they just kind of fall over. I mean, they could hardly do it because they were so out of everything. Well, that's the analogy here. What we've observed is that when people aren't reasonably fluent at things and they get interrupted or you ask them to do something for a period of time, it's really hard. How many times have you learned something new and then you try to start doing it and it's amazing, you get tired in 10 minutes and you want to go get a whatever, a cup of coffee or any excuse. You hope the phone rings, do a little web browsing, all that kind of thing. So what we've learned, and we've got lots, I did a lot of my doctoral work on this topic. We've got some pretty compelling data, and we could put you through some exercises if we had more time to show you, if it's not obvious, that this is true, that when you're fluent, you have endurance and resistance to distraction. And this is real important in jobs where immediate response is necessary. And then the third thing, and in a way this is the kind of bottom line issue, is application. What we find is that we can, and this goes back to the testing and people can't do it on the job and all that thing too, that if you aren't fluent at critical pieces of your skills and knowledge, and I then ask you to put them together in a real problem-solving situation or a real scenario or an actual, you know, work thing, you're less likely to be able to use those pieces. You're less likely to be able to put those things together. And again, there's a fair amount of work on that. You know, it came originally from kids' education, where we noticed that there were some kids in the fourth and fifth grade who could write answers to simple math problems, like 4 times 3 kind of problems, at maybe 50 or 60 a minute, which is about 1 a second, right? And if we move them forward to things like long division or story problems, they seem to be able to move fairly quickly through it. But if they were only 20 a minute, or 30 a minute on that, which means it takes you 2 or 3 seconds to figure out what 4 plus 7 is, which is big trouble, then you stuck them in the next level in the curriculum and they fell flat. They had a hard time. Now, the thing is, in those days, this was the 60s and 70s, we were kind of reinforcement theorists almost exclusively, and so we said, oh, well, just reward the kids who are slow, right? And they'll get better. So we'd gold stars or note home to mom, oh, you got 24 a minute today, that kind of thing. And what we found is we couldn't get that math facts behavior up. Reinforcement didn't work. And then what happened was somebody got the smart idea and they said, wait a minute, in writing the answers to these problems, you need to be able to read digits really fast and you need to be able to write numbers. And they went back and checked and they found that those kids could not write the numbers quickly and or they couldn't read the numbers quickly. So those components were not fluent and they held the whole thing down. Now, I've spent my life working with salespeople and customer service people and all kinds of other people where they had relatively complex repertoires. They had to know some facts. They had to maybe use some systems. They had to be able to make decisions. They had to be able to respond to certain questions. And if those pieces aren't fluent and I throw you into your job, it's really hard. But if I can figure out ways of building up those little pieces, it turns out it's way easier to put them together. So that's the third thing we know about. And these are obviously valuable. This isn't some kind of academic exercise here. So there's a lot more we could say about that, but that's kind of the summary of why fluency is important. Again, there's lots of stuff you can read if you want to. Here's an example of what it looks like. This is a really simple example, but this is from a call center where we had people learning. They were actually using flashcards, believe it or not, timed cards, where they were learning billing rates for different kinds of programs. They were learning different facts about sales promotions that they happened to be doing that month. And they were also learning certain things about product features. And each of these dots represent a count permitted of correct responding. And this is 4 or 5 people over a period of a couple weeks. And what you see is that people started at like 10 or 20 a minute correct, and there were errors. I'm not showing you the errors, but the errors went away eventually. And then eventually they got up, and we realized that if you could do most of these things between something like 70 or 80 a minute and 100 a minute, you had them nailed. We get them based on a few minutes a day practice. And then when you put these people in a situation where they had to use those facts to combine them and practice speaking about them and stuff, it came together really quickly. And in fact, this is actually data from a project we did that you'll find, if you look on our website, you'll find the article with me and Lee Sweeney, who is the manager of this call center. We were able to cut time training by a third, and we were able to improve productivity of these call center people by about 60% 2 weeks out of new hire training. Now, we didn't just use flashcards. We used a lot of other fluency-based stuff. But the idea is we built a repertoire, including fluent navigation, fluent facts, responding to questions, etc. Fluent use of job aids, by the way. So people really could pull those pieces together. Now, and this is, as I say, this is what the data really looked like. This is expressed as calls per minute, which is a little odd. But 0.1 would be per minute means it takes about 10 minutes to respond, to do a whole call in a call center. So that was the benchmark, a little bit, about 10 minutes per call. The people who went through the traditional training started about here when they were after they were newly hired, and they bounced around and they actually went down a little bit. They certainly didn't increase much. The people who had gone through the fluency training within a week or so hit the benchmark, and by 2 weeks they were about 60% faster than everybody else, and their accuracy was quite good in quality. And there's qualitative observations which correspond to some of your words that you came up with, like people were energized because they were, confident. People came out of training, and people were calling them bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Now, the classroom felt more like a gym because people were active, practicing stuff, quickly doing things, etc. And as my client said, by having a training program that's built around getting fluent on stuff, he described it as training at work speed. We know what the criteria are for being able to have conversations with people on the phone, use the system, do all this stuff, and we build a training program that enables people to develop those components to the point of fluency. So, some of you may know me in the context of the six boxes model. And if you think about this stuff from the six boxes point of view, if these are the factors or the variables that influence performance, we're talking about developing skills and knowledge, of course. But in order to do that, first of all, we set a very different set of expectations. And this goes back to the gentleman's comment earlier about our expectations are too low. So when we set a time criterion or a pace criterion for performance during training, all of a sudden the bar gets raised quite a lot. And we don't want to set a high bar and then punish people for not making it like No Child Left Behind does, by the way, to display my political views, but we do want to set high bars and then enable people to achieve them, and we can do that. We can do that very, very well if we know what we're doing. So expectations and feedback are a big part of it, and giving people an opportunity to measure and monitor their own performance with time criteria until they hit that level at their own pace is a big deal. But also, of course, we're talking about skills and knowledge, and tools and resources, which I already mentioned. So that's the sort of six boxes way of thinking about that. We want to be sure we set high expectations. We want to be sure that our systems and tools and job aids and practice materials and all that allow people to move fluently. And in the process, we're developing fluent skills and knowledge. So that's kind of a six boxes way of thinking about it. Does that make sense to you? Okay, but what this session is about is what we call fluency blockers and fluency builders, which I was actually talking about before I got into Gilbert's framework and the six boxes. And in fact, this article that I gave you preceded our use of the language of the six boxes. There's a chart in it called fluency factors. But the most relevant thing for you to look at is just the first page of the handout, which is a little job aid. And let me overview the categories a little bit, and then we can dip into the job aid. Because the idea here is, if I'm going into a performance or learning environment, and I'm trying to build fluent performance, what are the factors that can either get in the way of that or that can help make it happen faster? And so the first one is, as I've already mentioned, measurement. It's like those kids, you know. If we don't know the difference between 20 a minute and 70 a minute, if we just are measuring accuracy, we don't even know there's a problem. So we have to have a measurement system that takes the time dimension or the pace dimension into account. Now, in many cases, that means how many of something can you do per minute? In many cases, it means how long does it take you to do something, like complete a procedure? And in some cases, it just means achieving a pace that we can all agree on. In other words, you put two people together with some questions and answers that they need to get fluent on, and you say, look, you guys need to practice this until you can talk about the same comfort level and pace as you talk about the Friday, you know, Sunday afternoon football game. And once you get to that level, we can move on. That's what it means to be have the right quality and pace. So that's the first one. We have a measurement system that's sensitive to and allows us to know whether people are fluent or not, and more importantly, perhaps, allows the performer, the individual, to know how they're doing against some objective time-based standard. The second thing that we learn once we start measuring with time is we start noticing, whoops, a lot of our procedures actually prevent people from moving quickly. Or they don't give people enough opportunities. We have three examples, you know. We say, well, here's three examples. Oh, great, you know. Or we have learning procedures which slow people down. Actually, what we did here was an example of this. And if we had had more time and this was a workshop, I would have done this a little bit differently. But the thing is, remember what the procedure was. I asked you all to jot down as many ideas as you could in a minute. Now, I would bet, and this is what I do in workshops, if I said, okay, could you tell me how many you got, and then we write down the numbers, I'll bet you some people got two or three or four ideas, and some people might have gotten 15 ideas or more. And you were all able to go at your own pace. And if we shared them, and we did it again, everybody would be able to continue to accelerate. And some people would have, everybody could get to the 15 to 20 a minute range, depending on how many opportunities we gave you to practice, or if you did it on your own. But the idea is that the procedure itself allowed you to move quickly, allowed you an unlimited amount of, you know, you could do as many as you wanted. The normal way somebody would have done that would not look like that at all. It would have been something like, well, what do you guys think fluency is? You know, Barry, and you would have pointed to people one at a time, or you would have waited for the, you know, the aggressive people to raise their hands and the shy people not to, or whatever. But in a few minutes, we would have come up with maybe a few active responses. What we did, in fact, allowed all of you to make a bunch of active responding at your own pace. And I'll bet you we got 10 times as much behavior out of this room as we would have in the other procedure. So there's a key concept that I don't want to spend a lot of time on, but we talk about it as an opportunity multiplier. And the idea is, if I'm developing a practice activity, I'd like to have a new procedure that actually gives people a lot more opportunities to respond per unit time, because it's more efficient that way. So that's one of the key notions of changing our procedures for learning and practice so they allow people to move at their own pace and they encourage them to achieve whatever the standards are. Once you got that in place, something that sort of goes along with it is materials. Now, this can be true of learning materials, like clunky practice materials. It can also be true of job aids or reference materials. It goes back to the box two thing from six boxes. It's if you've got a bad user interface, if you got a document you can't find stuff in, you're in big trouble. Anybody here ever do product knowledge training? Okay. Were you involved in the days when the way you did this, among other things, was you got the thickest three-ring binder you could find, and then you like stuffed every brochure, PowerPoint, everything else in it and gave it to people, and maybe had some tabs? I mean, maybe you didn't do that because you're all really good at what you do, but this is a common practice. And then you're the salesperson. They say, oh, my God, how do I even find this stuff? And once I find it, this wasn't written for me. This was written for some, like, marketing thing. This didn't support me at all. So one of the things that I did when I had a company called Product Knowledge Systems is we went in and used that as a database, tore it apart, put it back in a structured documentation set that was actually built for what salespeople needed to do. And it dramatically improved performance without even doing any practice. It just meant people could now find the stuff they needed in the form they needed it. So that's the third thing. Once you notice it, once you change your practice procedures, then you notice, whoops, our materials are slowing people down. We better fix that. And then these last two kind of go together. But these I've already made allusion to, the idea that then the component behaviors, the skills, whether it's looking stuff up in the web, knowing certain facts, being able to respond to certain things, you know, inserting a seal inside of a machine that you have to get good at doing, whatever it is, those things have got to be pretty fluent. And so if we look at all of these things, we'll find where there's problems and we'll find where there are opportunities to make a difference. And so what you have in your hands, how are we doing time-wise? Okay. Is, we've got to move a little more quickly. What you have is this job aid. And so if you look at it carefully, you'll notice that we've broken these down a little, these things down a little more specifically. So under measurement, does the measurement method ignore the time dimension? Well, if it does, add some time-based performance measurement or evaluation component. Does it provide too few response opportunities to fill the allotted time? Think about this. This is the problem of testing. I have a test with 20 items on it. I give you 15 minutes to complete it. Some people finish it in 10 minutes. Some people take the full 15. They both get the same score. I don't know the difference. So if I'm giving a test, I want to be sure that there's enough opportunities there to fill up the allotted time for people so that when I then look at the time dimension, I can distinguish between the people who knew it well and the people who were kind of messing around. Lack explicit or sufficiently high fluency aims, which is a point you were making again earlier about setting standards, setting, you know, what are our measures of success? And then under procedures, do the procedures provide too few practice opportunities? Do they prevent learners from moving at their own pace? Do they limit the number of response opportunities? Do they slow people down? It's not so much a problem these days, but it used to be if people were doing e-learning of various kinds, they had these slow machines, right? I remember a simulation program at one of my software clients for salespeople, and there'd be this little video clip of some customer saying something, and then a few seconds later, a little multiple choice thing would show up on the screen, which said, should you tell them to go to whatever? Should you ask them this? Should you? You know, it was sort of a multiple choice to see how he should respond. Now, there's some problems with that format in the first place, but independent of that, the time delay between when the guy said whatever it was and the time you had your choices, it was like, wait a minute, what did he say again? And then it was a while to go to the next one. Well, in this hotel, I'm noticing that the wireless internet is a little bit like that. When I go to browse stuff, it's taking me quite a while. You know, I want to look up the latest political news, and I wind up leaving instead because it takes too long. So the point is, do the procedures slow me down? Or do they? And another one that's I think will make sense to you once you see it, if you focus too much on preventing errors, people get scared and they don't even try. So most of us have a history of punishment for errors, I think. And so what that means is, especially when I'm working with adults, I've got a whole set of strategies for making it okay. It's like green lighting. It's okay to make mistakes. Of course, it's not if you're running a nuclear plant or flying an airplane, and we'll focus on that. But, you know, for most learning purposes, it's okay. As Scott Hamilton, the figure skater, used to say, you never learn if you don't fall down. And so the idea is we encourage people to move quickly, and it's okay to make some mistakes, but you'll never get fluent if you don't have a chance, if you're not allowed to make mistakes. And if we really suppress errors, then people aren't even willing to try. So that's another big blocker. And then finally, these two skill and knowledge things. Well, the materials, I guess we have the materials. Provide too few examples, include unnecessarily wordy, this kind of stuff. And then do non-fluent skill elements, include either steps and procedures or chain skills, for example, that aren't fluent. Like a lot of times, there'll be, let's say, a sequence I'm supposed to go through with a customer, or maybe a mechanical maintenance procedure. And most of the steps are already in my repertoire, no problem. But on step 4 or 5, I got to know a fact, or I got to make a certain kind of decision, or I got to put a piece in that requires some skill. So we don't have to practice the whole procedure, but we better pull those little pieces out. It's like a driving range in golf, right? Driving is one of the important components, as is putting, as is various other things. So we pull that piece out, and we figure out how to do that a bunch to get good at it. So that's the idea of working on critical steps and procedures. What I call tool skills, which are prerequisites, things like actually being able to type if you're going to be using the computer a lot, things like that. And then do they have non-fluent knowledge elements? For example, knowledge requirements that you just need to have at the tip of your tongue. You can't find information, that sort of thing. So that's kind of a basic tool that will take you through looking at a learning or a performance environment, you know, what you could possibly fix. Now, I'd like to give you a little exercise now. Oh, wait a minute. I guess I don't want to do that yet. I'm going to go really quickly. I realize, as usual, I'm taking too much time. This is a simple model that you could find useful. The idea that in most learning, and I'm going to move real quickly here for a moment because I want to get to the exercise. The idea that when we learn anything, there's generally an initial stage where we acquire the initial learning and accuracy. And then, I'm sorry, I keep standing in front of you. And then there's a stage two, we call it, and that's where ideally we practice components for fluency and endurance. Now, my 10-year-old kid's drum teacher is really good at having my 10-year-old practice those components. But unfortunately, many of us as trainers and many educators these days especially jump from this stage where we barely are accurate to this stage where we're being asked to apply whatever it is, and we skip the practice components component. And the effect of that is that it's very hard to apply stuff. People don't like role plays because they can't do any of the pieces very well. Now you're asking them to do the whole thing. So this is a model. There's a lot more to talk about it. But the thing is, each of these stages, you need to kind of adjust your procedures and materials to really take them into account. And it's worth just even thinking a little bit about that. And again, if you read some of my articles, you'll get a lot more about it. But this is the golf example, you know, Sam Snead. I practice as much as anyone. For years, I hit 500 balls a day. Now, the question is, did he do 500 holes of golf? No, how did he do it? He changed the materials, right? Well, he didn't, but somebody did once. They came up with a driving range where you have buckets of 85 balls and you do 500 of them. You spend several hours hitting balls. So that's an example of where, to do practice, we need to change the procedures and materials to provide people brief opportunities to do things till they're fluent. And the idea of components that I've mentioned a few times, that's where it starts. Like, we practice links in larger chains. We practice key discriminations or decisions that are important pieces of bigger chunks. We then do stuff like, once those pieces are in place, we execute multiple things at once. We get good at dribbling and passing, or whatever it is, or, you know, catching and passing. Elements of associations, things like acronyms. Anybody in a world where you need to learn acronyms? Acronyms and their definitions. Well, a dead easy way to do that is practice cards, where you just got the acronym in the front and the words in the back or the other way around so you know what they are. It's no big deal once you get that, if you need it. Now, this is one of my favorite things, so I'm going to play it for you, just to sort of illustrate this from somebody who really knows about this stuff. This is my favorite guy.
You practice a lot?
Whenever I can. I don't practice as much as I would like to because I'm not around a big piano all the time. But I try to, you know, I try to practice a little bit every day for the most part.
And when you practice, I mean, do you practice the tunes that you'll be playing at the next concerts?
Oh,
are there old things?
No.
I guess the answer is no, you're saying.
No. I practice things like scales and chords and movement of my hands and things like that. Because, I mean, what I'm going to play on stage, I know. What I'm practicing for is to try to improve what I might play. You know, you got to practice. I mean, you got to keep your fingers loose. You got to keep your mind active, you know. Because what your mind think of, the question is, what your mind think of, can your fingers play it?
That's kind of the academic knowledge to the performance base, isn't it? The thing I love about this, and there's a lot of quotes you can get from athletes and others, is he gets it. He absolutely gets it. And anybody, how many musicians in the room? Anybody? You know what it's like, right? You're working on a piece and you got to go back and work on the bridge or the scale or something. It's tough. You get the pieces in place. We don't always have to start out with the components first. Sometimes you try the big chunk and then you have to go back to the pieces. But the fact is, component fluency is fundamental in most of the stuff we learn. And most of our training and development work doesn't really do a very good job with that. Part of it is because people are afraid that it will take even longer, right? But if you do it well, it doesn't always take longer. In fact, sometimes it takes shorter because that application happens much more easily. And I've got lots of cases that, you know, I could share with you about that. Now, if you summarize a lot what I've been saying, You know, a lot of people say practice, that's drill and kill. We want real kind of authentic learning and stuff. And there's a lot of nastiness in the language some people use about practice. What I would say based on the research is that a lot of traditional drill and practice fails for a number of reasons. One is usually because there's no explicit fluency criterion. It's just, well, practice this until you get better. What does that mean? If I have an aim, if I become like a track runner, I know I got to beat my 3-and-whatever-minute mile. I know what my aim is, and I'll keep practicing. When we do that with learners, a lot of times we find them practicing on their own at their coffee breaks, and people say, wow, that's amazing. Well, it's because we empowered them with knowing what it means to be good at it and giving them a way to get there. Second thing is, a lot of times we stretch endurance. If people are not fluent, more than 5 minutes can be a long time. So what we usually want to do is work on small chunks briefly, what we call sprints or bursts. And then, you know, once people get pretty quick for a short time, we start stretching it out. And that applies to a lot of things. Often the chunks are too big, and by that I mean we're doing things like working on the role play. Now, the role play might involve being good at responding to certain critical questions, restating a fuzzy thing the person said, doing two or three other things. And I can't do any of those very well. So it makes a lot more sense to spend a few minutes getting a little bit fluent on those things before I try to put them together. So those are some of the reasons. There's another reason, too. I came up in a Catholic school tradition, and I'm very pleased to say that even though I had mostly nuns in grade school, I had all the nice ones, apparently, because there's all these scare stories, you know, about getting whacked on the hand and stuff. I never had that. But, you know, the story goes that a lot of times practice is motivated by you'll get hit if you don't do it, figuratively or literally. And that also doesn't help any. We can set positive goals for people and reward people for personal best and make it a lot of fun. So really, this is just the flip side of that, so I'm not going to talk about it. So going back to the job aid, were there any questions about the job? Is it fairly straightforward? We went through it kind of quickly, but does it make sense? Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, let me give you two or three examples. The areas where, for example, like sales or customer service, which are a lot of verbal behavior, where you got to be able to look stuff up, you got to be able to talk about things in a communicative way, you got to be able to do things like customize and deliver presentations, you got to be able to use language fluently, that kind of stuff. You can practice all those things in different ways. I can, for example, let's say we're working on restating a... Either asking somebody for more information in a supervisory or sales or customer service way, when they say something to you, knowing whether you have to ask some more because they didn't tell you the whole story, or being able to just clarify what they said to be sure you got it right. I can have 50 examples and throw at you of fuzzy statements, and you practice saying them back to me in a clearer way. And if we work in pairs like that, we can get real good at it. Or I've already used examples like looking up stuff in the computer. I can give people a whole set of little things to find or do on the computer, and I can say, see if you can do this whole sequence within 4 minutes. And then you give them a bunch of versions of that until they get real comfortable with that part of the system, and then you take them to another part. Or let's say with a salesperson, I'm trying to get them to be able to link statements of problems or needs they might hear from customers to the kinds of features that they have in their product that would solve those. I can give them things like practice sheets where there's a bunch of statements of problems or needs and they have to put a little letter that corresponds to the type of need. Or I can do things like give them practice cards where on the front it says some problem, in the back it's the product that would address that. I mean, there's a lot of ways I can teach verbal associations. I can teach people to do presentations by having them work on two or three slides at a time with a buddy. I mean, actually, LG, CNS, a Korean company, did a brilliant job in that, in enabling people to deliver presentations better, fluently, as an example. So there's lots of ways. And on the real soft side of skills, that's a relatively new frontier for us, but it's still quite possible to break down supervision, feedback, management of meetings, all kinds of things into small chunks and practice them. Does that help a little bit? Okay. All right, so what I'd like to do now is have you turn to the next page and do a little exercise to see if you have this discrimination. This is a little fluency exercise, actually, and we're only going to do it once but because we don't have much time. But you'll notice up in the top, it says being fluent means to be able to do between 40 and 30 correct per minute. We put the high number first just to make you not just stop at the minimum, you know. But what that would mean is if you could get down to about here in a minute, you'd have this stuff down. The fact is, first time out, you're not going to be there. But you can practice examples of this and get pretty quick. So all you're doing is you're reading this and you're putting a plus in it if it looks like it's a fluency builder to you, a positive factor, and you're putting a negative, a minus in there if it looks like it's a blocker. Does that make sense to you? So let me give you a minute, and if you got pencils ready, let's see how many you can do. Please begin. Please stop. Now, did anybody make it to the bottom of the first side? All right, so you're more than halfway to the aim. So if you kept, anybody make it maybe a halfway down the first side? A lot of people? So you're about a third of the way to the aim. So you keep doing that, you get practice at it. Let's go through them. You actually have the answer sheet in the next page. But let's see. You know, one of the things is I'm a little bit combining stage one and stage two here because I gave you kind of a lecture. And now we're doing some practice with a lot of opportunities, but we're also going to probably do some correcting of errors. So there's sort of, we're fading from initial acquisition into a fluency building phase. So how about the first one? Did people put a negative for that? That's my sort of beef about Microsoft Word, as you might have noticed. Anybody? Okay. Well, why don't you look at them, and are there any you disagree with or are puzzling to you? That's the easy way to do it. And then we can correct any either miswriting on my part or misunderstandings on yours. Oh, are they? Which one?
The web page refreshes in under 5 seconds. The question is, web page refreshes.
Oh, did I give you the wrong one? Oh, no. Word processor automatically. Which ones? I'm sorry. You know what? Oh, okay. That's pretty funny. By mistake, that's a complete mistake on my part of picking an old version. Well, either one is fair enough, but actually, this is from a workshop, and by this time we would have discussed some data which say that when it takes 7 seconds or so for a web page to refresh, especially a commercial one, people tend to go someplace else. So that's a bad example. Is that the only one you found out? Oh, geez.
Versus
what? Okay, so what you see is I was rewriting these and I gave you two versions of it. I apologize for that.
1 minute, jotting down ideas as opposed to stop.
Okay, so I apologize. You got two iterations of the same thing. But I think the answers would be the same. I'm not sure, but I think they would. But I may be wrong. Okay, any other ones beside my mess? See, got my errors. That's pretty far out. Yes, sir.
I think we've done a fairly good job at acknowledging the time dimension.
Yep.
But in a sense, it's almost been to our detriment because now we realize that in our environment, the competitive factor is around customer service time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking to move more towards training a lot more in the affective domain.
Yep.
And in that scenario, I'm a little hesitant to say I want to push or promote time dimension more than we just want.
Well, let me say a couple things about that. That's a classic measurement thing, which is you get what you ask for, right? And if it's and most call centers are driven by calls per hour, so what you described is I've worked in a lot of call centers, so that's a common problem. However, what I would suggest is that if you want to work on the quality thing, then let's define a whole bunch of exercises where we're not talking about going fast, but we're talking about smoothly responding. So there's all kinds of exercises where we can do things like starting out discrimination, give you a whole bunch of examples that you either listen to or you read or you hear from a buddy that are not so good ways to say things. And then which are the, how would you improve on that? Or maybe just which are the good ones and which are the bad ones? And then and then the next step would be how would you improve on that? And then a third step would be, you know, actually we pair off and you say something to me and I respond. And we can, the thing is, with the normal confident pace type of time dimension, we might have a checklist about the words you should use and the qualitative things, but we're also talking about getting confident in doing that. So we can apply this time dimension idea there as long as we look at the pace rather than just doing it fast.
That's a very good point. So yeah. It's not necessarily at the time of performance.
It's yeah.
It is
about smoothness, though, because, again, then if you click a couple clicks back here, one of them then is, how about finding stuff on the web? If you've got an intranet situation or a customer service relationship or customer relationship management type software, if people aren't fluent at finding stuff, two things happen. First of all, they're having to, like, fill in with small talk if they're not fast, or, and they sound distracted to the customer. And the second thing is they might actually come up with the wrong answers. So I would like to build a foundation of absolutely stone-cold fluency in finding information. And then once I'm there, I want to be able to show people screens and say, tell me about what you see. Talk about it as you would to a customer. So I want to build this foundation. One of the things we found in AT&T Wireless, and you'd probably enjoy reading the article, you can download it, is that when we got the fundamentals like web browsing and certain facts and all that down so they were fluent, people had more attention for the customer service. They could pay attention to the customer because they weren't like freaking out that they didn't know stuff and couldn't find things. So the two go together. Okay, so anyway, that's an example of a fluency exercise. What we could now do, or we can just talk for 15 minutes if you want, is we have a scenario at the last page here. And this would be kind of an application exercise. And what this scenario is we could give, I mean, as I say, we've got about 15 minutes, I think. We end at 3:30. Is that correct? Okay. So we can do one of two things. Either we can just talk, and you can try this on your own, because I have the school book answers here, and I can hand them out. So what the task is you go through this scenario, and what you're trying to do is identify either sort of positive fluency factors, fluency builders, or fluency blockers, opportunities to do something different. And what we usually do is we give people maybe 10 minutes to go through that, just writing little pluses and minuses, underlining things, and then we have a discussion about it. Now, I've sort of gabbed on a little bit longer, so we can either do that, and then I can hand you out these, and you can check it out, or I can just hand you out these, and you can do it on your own. How many people, let's do a vote, how many people would like to do the exercise, even though it'll take up to the last minute? All right, I think we're pretty clear on this one. How many people would just like to talk for a few minutes? Okay, cool, that's great. But let me, in the meantime, if my helper here can hand you out the school book answers, people find other things in there that aren't in here, by the way. But this will give you a little idea of how to look at a case from a fluency builder's, fluency blocker's point of view. So let me just see, is there anything else I wanted to share with you here? That's the school book answers. Nope, we're here. So questions, comments? Well, when I say just starting 25 years ago, probably, what I mean is that most of my clients do, frankly, focus on a lot of this other stuff that isn't so much soft skills, although a lot of it is related, as we were just speaking a minute ago, because if you can lay a foundation of knowing the facts, finding the information, et cetera, in the world that I've worked in, which tend to be things like tech support, customer service, sales, other areas that are knowledge work with customers, what I've found is if you lay that foundation of fluent sort of technical performance and knowledge, that it's just a lot easier for people to be nice and all that. So that's an area that I work in. But we've also had people who've done some fairly innovative things around soft skills. What soft skills area are you interested in?
Management development, leadership development.
Okay.
So coaching, feedback, performance, and all those.
Gotcha. A lot of them interactive stuff. Okay, so the thing is, that's not too complicated. If you take, you probably usually do various kinds of scenario role play things, right? I mean, that's a big part of that usually, where you're trying to simulate the final performance. Now, I don't know if this is what you do, but what I've observed is that in many, many such programs, again, there's some initial learning thing. There's some discussion about it. You might give people a model or something. There might be a bunch of scenarios that people talk about on video or something. And then you jump people into, often, into some kind of role plays. Is that kind of true?
Kind of.
Is there anything in between where people practice on smaller chunks?
Yeah, we break them out. We do scenarios and they do a small piece
okay.
of it. And then
well, that's in the right direction. So the idea would be, if I take one of the a real scenario type of situation that likely might happen, if I do the analysis where I say what are the decisions people need to make, what are the principles they need to apply, which kind of are the same thing, what language do they need to select, in what ways do they need to, for example, restate what the other person says, or question. I mean, start listing the skills and knowledge in there, and then say, are there some of these that really are challenging that people, that when you look at people trying to do the whole scenario, they're having a especially hard time with? If that's the case, figure out some way to pull that piece out and give people a bunch of chances. And I mean, a lot of this winds up, in my experience, being things like, I'm going to give you, you guys pair up, we've talked about this, I'm going to give you 50 cards, and it has, there's a whole lot of fuzzy statements on here. And I just want you to read it to your buddy and then have him try to restate it, or have a nice response to it, or whatever the thing is you're trying to work on, until you both feel rather comfortable, and we've sort of covered the waterfront in terms of the kinds of situations likely to come up. So that's the general idea, and there's been a lot of applications, sort of spotty applications of that. So when I say it's new, I mean it's an area people are less inclined to go into. But I think it's straightforward. And if you were interested in emailing or whatever, I'd be happy to work with you on it, because I'm real interested in that area of having very compelling examples where people say, wow, it made an enormous difference. Yes? I'm sorry.
How do you deal with clients who feel that this is wasted time?
Why would they say it was wasted, by the way?
Well, I think generally, I don't know what other people's experience is, but often clients come to you with an idea of how much time they want to spend on something.
Mm-hmm.
Where they know how much time it really wants
to take.
That's right. So they say, oh, we're going to give you 2 days to do this. And if it takes a week, you need to figure out how you're going to get this done in 2 days. And you can tell them, well, I can't accomplish this in 2 days, but you have 2 days. So when you come to activities like this, these are the things that I find that I'm doing battle.
You're triaging, so to speak. Well, there's three or four pieces to that. One of the reasons, by the way, that I'm not, I mean, I spent about 15 years aggressively, well, I spent about 12 years with having a company called Product Knowledge Systems. And we had a complete solution to the problem of complex sales knowledge, where people had to know about products and industries and trends and be able to talk to about competition, et cetera, et cetera. We combined good documentation, fluency practice in classrooms, coaching activities, the whole deal. And we made some enormous impacts with big product launches and so forth. I had a whole teams of people working for me and all that. I've been doing that for a few years for a variety of reasons. Largely because I'm working more in a sort of a virtual way with associates, and I don't do big projects anymore. But for then another maybe 8 years, I worked hard to take this methodology into call centers and sales organizations. And what I found was, to be perfectly honest, is people would get quite excited about it, but it's like turning the Queen Mary. There's quite a lot of changes in opposition. There's the kinds of things you're mentioning. There's the fact that people are wedded to their percent correct tests. It's the fact that they already aren't very performance-oriented anyway, so I have to change. So there's a whole lot of problems, okay? So what you described is a small subset. But to get more specific... all of those. I'm sure you have. But to get more specific, there's also philosophical objections. The time deal freaks people out. That's when you have to start appealing to examples outside of training and development and education and, sports and music and stuff. And especially if the person you're talking to has any history in any of those things, you talk to them about that. But then there's a point where, first of all, hardcore performance technology becomes relevant. And by that I mean we focus on the work outputs and we get rid of all the unnecessary stuff that we waste time on because it's nice to know. So that's a big first step. And my client, Lee Sweeney, that was my sort of biggest star client in a customer service environment, he had a thing called the bullseye model that I've started talking to people about. And man, he said, look, in new hire training, for example, we want people to be able, it's an 80-20 rule, we want people to be able to handle 80% of the stuff the first 6 weeks on the job. That's what new hire training's about. The rest they'll figure out later. So he would like slash and burn his training programs. This guy was a business guy, really, not so much a training guy. So that's the first thing. Get the curriculum down so it's focused on the actual performance, and that gets you some time usually. Second thing is, if you do a good job on identifying the components that we've been talking about that actually make a difference, and if you, for example, instead of practicing starting out with big role plays or scenarios of one kind or another, you scale down to the pieces bit and you do some good timed practice on that until people hit good, quick aims. And there's a whole, I mean, I'm glossing over stuff like how you set those aims and all that. But what often happens is that then transition into the application is way easier. Because now when I throw people into a scenario, they've got the pieces down and they can do it. I mean, my first experience with this in product training was in Toronto Dominion Bank 30 years ago or something like that, 20-some years ago. And I remember halfway, that what they did is we had some pre-study based on the on fluency building things. And then there were these half-day case study scenarios that these young new bankers would go through and try to identify the needs of the customer and talk about them and talk about what products they were going to sell them and a whole kind of big role-play complex situation. And the people we were partnering with were very good traditional sales training designers. So they did a really good job on these scenario things. And their experience was it usually took 3 or 4 of these half-day things to get the people comfortable with them. First time out, after the fluency building practice, I was sitting next to the training manager at Toronto Dominion, who was a former salesperson himself, or a relationship manager. And halfway through the first team's scenario presentations and stuff, he turned to me and he said, you know, I sold this stuff for 6 years, and these kids know this better than I do. So they did the first day, and it was pretty good. And then they did a second one a couple days later. And at the end of the second one, the trainees sent a representative up front, and they said, look, we don't really need the third one. It's okay. So that was my first indication that we might be able to cut time. And then the Lee Sweeney example from the call center, and I admit, all the stars lined up in that. There's a whole lot of six boxes things that just came together. But as I mentioned, we cut training by a third, and we increased productivity by 60%. So I believe you can squeeze out the fat. You can focus on the real need to know, and not just the need to know, but for instance, in call centers, there's typically a pretty long ramp up. And what I've discovered is one of the major problems there is system use. Because people aren't fluent first day out using the systems. And so the gating factor is often that they just are kind of poking around until they finally figure out how to find stuff. If we can have that stuff fluent first day on the job, it's amazing how quickly other stuff can kick in. So I can't make any promises. I always tell my clients, I'm not going to promise to shorten your training. But I'm guarantee we can improve the performance results of the given amount of time. And I'm pretty sure we might be able to squeeze it down depending on what you're... And the other thing, the other pieces I wanted to mention. A lot of times if you've got a day or a half day or an hour like this, you can't build much fluency in this period of time. But everybody's talking about coaching now anyway. So we can empower supervisors or self-directed learners or various other ways for people to continue practicing discrete activities until they could get it. It's like the guy who goes to the driving range every Saturday afternoon. He can get better at that thing. Is that helpful, at least a little bit conceptually?
I've done a lot of that already.
I know. It's very challenging. I won't disagree with you.
People who are cutting down so far. And I heard the question around soft skills versus technical skills.
Yes.
In the soft skills area, I mean, so much of they depend on selection rather than.
Of the people?
Uh-huh. You select or you hire in for
it can.
Personality.
Absolutely.
Well.
That's right.
Working on other stuff is much more amenable to the reputation of the people.
Fair enough.
Changing personality, boy, you have a real challenge.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough.
You can teach a tall person to dribble, but you can't teach a good dribble.
Short person to dunk or whatever. Yeah. I think that's fair enough. Although, to be fair, my experience has been that companies usually do a pretty good job in the selection thing. They don't usually assign the geeks to the customer service. I mean, pardon me, but you know, the sort of nerdy, not friendly people to the customer service jobs unless they're forced to, or vice versa. True enough. Yeah. Fair enough. So that is a big issue sometimes. But I also believe, based on my observation, that there's an enormous potential for improvement because we really don't do practice very well. And so anytime when there's any role plays or scenario stuff going on, we can usually analyze out at least a few pieces of that, that if we provide even a minimum amount of practice, because remember, typically people get 4 or 5 chances to do something. If we can come up with a way to give them 20 chances or 50 chances in a short period of time, a little piece, man, it's a big multiplier. Anyway, our time is up. Thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it. And again, one last thing, I really encourage you to check out this web page because there's probably 15 to 20 articles about different applications and things on fluency.